Well, today's agriculture supports 7.2 billion people. Tomorrow's agriculture must support 9.1 billion people, and most of them will live in cities. This leads us to ask, which agriculture will feed our future? Ecological or industrial?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 988th edition of the Food Chain Radio Program right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Punta Arenas who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Aaron Shore on the boards. Hello, Aaron.
Good morning.
Aaron, I have a question for you.
All right.
Now, which agriculture do you think will feed our future billions? Will it be industrial agriculture, or will it be ecological agriculture?
I think it's a toss-up. Depends on which direction we decide to go with.
Okay. When we get to the fork in the road and we take it, we'll know, right?
That's right.
Well, folks, those who count say there are 7.2 billion of us living here on planet Earth. Those who estimate say that by 2050 there will be 9.1 billion, and 70% of which will be living in cities. Now, to feed our future's billions, the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization estimates agriculture must increase production by 70%. There are two basic approaches or strategies agriculture can pursue to achieve this increased production. One strategy for feeding our future's billions is to amplify the biological processes of nature. We'll call this approach ecological, for want of a better term. One example of ecological agriculture is that discovered by U.S. Secretary of Agriculture F.H. King, who in the year 1900 paid a visit to the ancient agrarian world of China. Said King in his subsequent book entitled Farmers of 40 Centuries, "With our broad fields, our machinery and few people, their system appears to us crude and impossible. But cut our holding to the size of theirs, and the same stroke makes our machinery, even our plows, still more impossible. And so the more one studies the environment of these people, their numbers, what they have done and are doing, against what odds they have succeeded, the more difficult it becomes to see what courses might have been better." The other strategy, which we will call industrial for its factory-like scale, seeks to increase production by redirecting the biological processes of nature. Examples of industrial agriculture abound in America's heartland, where, with the help of plants genetically re-engineered to contain pesticides and to withstand herbicides, one can find individual farmers, a single farmer, growing 1,000 acres of crops with no weeds or pests. The divergent paths these two forms of agriculture take toward feeding our future lead us to some interesting questions. Can either ecological or industrial agriculture increase production of food by 70%? Should we, the people, through our governments, encourage the development of one agriculture at the expense of the other? And of course, which agriculture will likely win the competition to feed our future's billions? Will it be the industrial agriculture, or it will be the ecological? Here to help us sail off into the future, we have two distinguished warriors from the battlefields of agricultural thought. We have John Kempf and Misha Popoff. John, we'll start with you. You're the CEO of Advancing Ecological Agriculture, right?
Yes, I am.
Well, welcome to the Food Chain. So happy to have you aboard today. Now, John, we understand you're from an Amish background.
Yes, from an Amish community in northeast Ohio, just south of Lake Erie.
Good. And you moved out into the world from the Amish community and are now the CEO of Advancing Eco-Agriculture. So tell us a little bit about that business.
Advancing Eco-Agriculture is known for helping farmers grow crops that are completely resistant to diseases and insects using nutrition. So fundamentally, we help farmers grow crops that have complete nutritional integrity and greatly reduce, or in some cases are successful in even eliminating the need for pesticides by enhancing plant immunity and at the same time regenerating soil health and ecological diversity as well.
Good to go. Who paves the way?
When we work with farmers, we are simply changing their agronomic models and their plant nutrition models. So we're using the farm's current fertility and pesticide input budget to change what they're doing. We're not putting in any additional investments.
Okay. Basically, farmers pay you to do your work, and there you are.
Yep.
Good to go. Also with us today, we have Misha Popoff, who is the author of Is It Organic? Misha, welcome to the Food Chain.
Good morning.
Pleased to have you aboard. Let's see, you're down there in Texas, right?
Yes, we moved down to Texas from British Columbia in Canada.
Okay, great. Now, Misha, you came from a background as an organic inspector, as I understand it. So you inspected organic farms, is that correct?
Yeah, and before that I was an organic grain farmer in Saskatchewan in the prairies of Canada. But yes, I worked for 5 years as a USDA contract organic inspector.
Okay, and then you kind of went rogue.
In my view, Michael, I think the organic industry went rogue. We sort of quit thinking about what your other guest here is just talking about, and the organic industry relies now mainly on imports of organic, quote-unquote organic food, from places like China, Mexico, and Argentina. The organic industry relies very little in America on farmers like the ones that are clients of the other of the other guests.
Okay, good. Now, you wrote a book, Is It Organic?, and in which you pretty much lay out the case for the notion that the organic industry has gone astray.
Yes.
Okay, and Misha, we always ask, who pays the way?
Who pays? Like, who pays me?
Yes.
Yeah, no one. No one pays me. I occasionally do public speaking engagements. I've done those for agricultural organizations like Far West Agribusiness Association up in Washington and the Southern Crop Production Association down in Georgia. I've done maybe 20 engagements since I met you, Michael. Oh, you know, I guess you and I met probably 5 years ago.
Yep.
So that pays a bit. But other than that, I do a lot of other things. I write political columns totally unrelated to agriculture and I also do, I've done construction. I've sold photocopiers. I've got 3 kids, so I got to keep everyone fed here. I don't make money off of my opinion that the organic industry has really gone astray. I don't really make a living off of that.
Okay, fair enough. Well, today we're going to look at the future and, you know, what 35 years or so we're looking into the future and those who estimate it's going to be 9.1 billion people living on Earth and that to feed those people, agriculture is going to have to increase production 70%. And we're scratching our head going, oh yeah, how is this going to happen? So let's look at our agriculture and ask that question, you know, can ecological or industrial agriculture increase production by 70%. John Kemp, let's start with you. You're advancing ecological agriculture. Can ecological agriculture actually produce a lot of food?
I would contend that the answer is yes, that ecological agriculture can meet the world's food supply demands. And however, I would also suggest that more than just thinking about the dialogue in terms of a contrasting of ecological versus industrial food, I think that we also need to consider some other fundamental changes to our food supply and our food production. For example, today in this country, we're growing millions of acres of corn and soybeans, which contribute indirectly to our food supply, but not directly. If we were able to, not if, but I believe when, because I expect this is going to happen, when we begin converting some of that acreage to production of actual food crops, such as tomatoes or cabbage or any given variety of fruit or vegetable crops, we can produce significantly more food, many times more food per acre than we are producing today.
Good enough. Misha, what about the industrial model? Do you think the industrial model can generate 70% more food for us by 2050?
I think right now, all of agriculture, whether it's organic or industrial or GMO or conventional, I think it's all agriculture has its hands tied right now because we're stuck in the middle of a political debate. And people like you are doing a lot to sort of quieten things down. Like you bring me and John on here, and we have a good debate, and we probably agree like 65 or 70%. But meanwhile, the activists are going for the throat of companies like Monsanto and Bayer Crop Science. They're going for the throat of the USDA.
And with that thought, we'll have to hold it. While the activists have their hands on the throat of the USDA, we're asking the question, which agriculture will feed our future? We need to produce 70% more. How are we going to do it? Misha Popoff and John Kempf and you, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, right back.
Get this. You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
House plants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city green belts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at MetroFarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at MetroFarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-, 6-, or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at MetroFarm.com. That's MetroFarm.com.
You know, where we now stand, many will stand in the year 2050. Gosh, they say 9.1 billion of us will be here, and they will all need to be fed. That means agriculture must step up to the plate and produce 70% more food than it now produces. Oh my goodness, that's a big job. Could you do 70% more in your job today than you're doing? What would it take for you to do that? I would take a lot for me to do that. So let's talk about what agriculture can do. And there's two basic formats. One is we call ecological, for lack of a better term. It's that agriculture that really seeks to amplify natural processes, and the industrial model, which kind of redirects the natural processes. So let's start with John Kempf, who is the CEO of Advancing Ecological Agriculture. John, what exactly, when you go to farmers, can you say, boy, you can really increase your production, and this is a way of doing it? Well, how would we do that?
One of the things that we have observed in the work that we do with farmers, we consistently observe sometimes very surprising yield increases. And the reason we're seeing these increases, I believe, is there's a couple of synergistic reasons that are happening here. But the first is that we take a fundamentally different approach to plant nutrition. Mainstream agronomy has focused on plant nutrition with a single-minded emphasis on improving yields. We have looked at plant nutrition from a different perspective in that we want to enhance plants so that they have a functional immune system and have very high levels of quality. And when you improve plant health, you can't stop yields from happening. So what we have observed is that as soils begin regenerating and as crops become healthier and healthier, we consistently see very strong yield increases from a broad variety of the fruit and vegetable crops that we work with all across the country.
So nutrition is a very big part of the ecological model then. We got to get the plants the right food so they can take care of business for themselves.
I would say that nutrition is really the foundation, since we look at genetics and how we can enhance plant genetics for greater yields and so forth. But at the end of the day, genetics, or even with genetic engineering, are only a very small piece of what impacts the production of any given crop. We have the science of epigenetics today because the basic premise of epigenetics is simply that environment determines genetic expression. And in agriculture, environment is simply climate mediated by nutrition. So the nutrition that plant has is going to affect a great deal of its genetic expression and the yield potential that it could possibly deliver.
Kind of a combination there, right?
Absolutely.
Misha Popov, what about nutrition in the industrial model? How do we approach the notion in the industrial world?
To be honest, I guess they're probably not as concerned about it as John is and as most honest American organic farmers are. That is more of a mainstay of the organic industry. But as I was saying before the break, there has to be cooperation here, but unfortunately, the leaders of the organic industry, not John, but the leaders of the organic industry who negotiated the National Organic Program during the Clinton administration, they made it impossible for there to be any cooperation. So they vilified Monsanto.
Well, we want to pick up the cooperation bit a little bit down the road here, but with respect to the models,
I would say this. I would say that conventional farmers are totally open to the idea of adopting organic practices, but the organic industry has made the two-way street impossible. In other words, there's no way, even if an organic farmer wants to adopt some conventional practices, they're prevented from doing that by law. So let me ask. One-way street at best.
Okay, fine. It's a one-way street. But with respect to nutrition, how does industrial model approach its nutrition? If it's not concerned about nutrition, how does industrial model feed plants?
Yeah, it's more on volumes. They're just looking for higher yields, and they assume that if they feed the plant, from the NPK fertilizer formula, it's mainly the first one, the nitrogen. And the theory is that the more robust the plant, the more the plant can seek out nutrients, trace minerals, and what have you in the soil. And that theory has held really for, almost a century now. We've been using synthetic ammonium nitrate since 1917. But, it's quite right. I lived it on an organic grain farm, as I mentioned in the intro. We're just depleting our soil. We're really living on a fantasy that NPK provides the vast spectrum of nutrients that a human body or that a cow or a chicken needs. And you only get the full spectrum of nutrition from more of an organic philosophy.
So you're kind of the same mind as John Kemp then, that NPK salt fertilizers do not do the entire job of allowing the plant to fully express themselves.
No, you're sort of mainlining the plant with what it needs to look robust and healthy. And yes, a more robust and healthy plant, its roots will seek out the trace minerals in the soil because they're going to be longer and more vigorous. But the theory only holds true for so long. I mean, it would be like if you ate a diet of starch, sugar, and protein. I mean, if you just synthesize those three items, that's really what food is, it's starch, sugar, and protein. But you wouldn't really be eating, Michael. You might last a little while. You'd do fine. People say, look at Michael. He's saving all sorts of money. And after a while, you'd start succumbing to disease, quite accurately, as John puts it, because you'd be lacking all of the other things that really make food food.
Well, John, there doesn't seem to be much promise in that notion then, does there?
I would say that our simple-minded approach to plant nutrition has directly led to the overwhelming explosion of diseases and insects that we have had in our agricultural field. Essentially, what is happening is that our plants today lack nutritional integrity. They no longer have the needed enzyme cofactors, adequate levels of manganese and cobalt and zinc and copper and so forth. So what is resulting is that we have plants that have non-functioning immune system. Exactly the same concept holds true. We know that for ourselves. We know we have friends who never get sick. We have other friends who get sick very frequently with the first cold or flu bug that comes along. The only difference between those two is how well their immune system has been supported with nutrition over the course of their entire lifetime. That exact same concept holds true for plants as well. If we make sure that plants have complete nutritional integrity and address all the trace minerals, then we can produce truly healthy plants, and we will have greatly reduced disease and insect pressure.
Misha, is there a way for the industrial model to provide all of the nutrition required by plants? If right now we're just focusing on NPK and not on any of the secondary or trace soil nutrients, is there a way for industrial agriculture to pony up the goods?
A lot of farmers choose to do so, and you see that more in the market gardens and the orchards. You don't see that on the large-scale grain operations like soy and canola. Those guys are literally just going for bushels per acre. But, yeah, on the more specialized end of conventional agriculture, you see a lot more crossover between the industrial model and the ecological model or the organic model. And that's by choice. That's by personal choice. So if a guy or a gal is growing vegetables for Whole Foods Market, they know that the vegetables don't have to just look great. They got to, taste great. And heaven forbid, maybe someone does a nutritional analysis on them and realizes, hey, the iron is way up. Well, farmers don't add iron to their soil. And how did that happen? Well, as John is describing, it was a literally quite natural and healthy plant. So then the iron is expressed in the broccoli or what have you, or in the spinach. And that, what I'm pushing for is a lot more crossover. And as I said,
that's what we all, that's what we're going to get down when we get down the road here just a little bit. But when we come back, I want to ask what I see about the real big difference between the two models, and that is the input of labor. And the having people in the field, and it seems like one is heading in that direction and the other is heading away from that direction. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with John Kemp, Misha Popoff, and you. We're talking about what kind of agriculture is going to feed the future's billions. Right back. One of my favorite looks into the future of agriculture was actually a look at the past of agriculture in a book by F.H. King, who was Secretary of U.S. Agriculture way back at the turn of the last century. 1900, he went to China to visit the China farmers of China, perhaps to take along a carpet bag filled with modern agriculture tricks. But when he got to China, he discovered something that couldn't quite fit with his Western industrial model. And that was the fact that China supported itself by small farms, which by virtue of the times were very ecological in that they stressed the amplification of natural processes and the husbanding of resources. But really, the principal input in the whole thing was the alertness and efficiency of the gray matter of all of those farmers' brains. Lots of smart people growing food right there for themselves. Now, when we look into the future of our world, those who estimate say 9.1 billion of us are going to live here, and most of us are going to live in cities. And so, we look at the industrial model of our times, and we've seen that farmers have really been very smart or very good at replacing people with money. And you take money and you go out and you buy chemicals and you buy genetically modified seeds, and then you can grow 1,000 acres of crops with no people. Amazing stuff. So that is the essential direction of these two different worlds. John Kemp, do you think that the ecological farming technologies can survive without that alertness and efficiency of the gray matter of farmers?
I don't think that it should desire to be completely honest with you. I believe that we produce the healthiest, highest quality food when we have a lower, what I refer to as eyes to acres ratio. Farming is a very difficult profession, and what attracts many people to farming and to agriculture is their desire to have that connection to life and living processes. And from my perspective as a consultant, working with thousands of farms all across the country, very consistently, the smaller scale farmers are doing a better job. They care for their soil. They care for the crops that they're doing. And there is an additional dimension of care and attention that happens on smaller scale agriculture. And I believe that is really the direction that we need to go to have a viable regenerative agriculture for the future.
What about you, Misha? Can we put people back into industrial agriculture and make it work?
Well, really, only if we sort of forced them, either coercively or through economic forces, force people. People don't want to be farmers. And up against F.H. King, I would put Sir Albert Howard, the British agronomist, who went to India after World War One and discovered the Indore process of composting. And you're probably always going to need more people on the land when it's organic or ecological farming. But the Indore process can be done on an industrial scale. In fact, a lot of the organic dairies in America are doing just that. And, so he brought this back, sort of the same scenario. He went to India, Sir Albert Howard, believing he was going to sort of educate the Indians on Western agriculture, and ended up coming home with more than he went with, and, as I say, brought back the Indore process. But there's nothing wrong with industry. It just has to be applied in the right way.
Mm-hmm. Is there room in the industrial model for people? I mean, it seems like industrial agriculture has been extremely successful by its own definition by replacing the input of time or people with that of money.
Yeah, only on large-scale grain and oilseed operations. If we look at market gardens or, as I mentioned, dairy or the meat industry, those are still very people-intensive. I mean, sure, there's some large ranchers out there, but really ranching across America and across Canada, you're still dealing with herd sizes, say, 100 to 200 head. And that's really manageable for a husband, wife, and their kids. And sure, like I say, there's the odd one where you see 1,000 head of beef cattle, and certainly Aurora Organic Dairies is into that realm with dairy cattle. But no, what you're describing is really the grain and oil seed market, where they basically, as you described, you could have a couple of farmers managing literally thousands of acres, as you said, they've really taken the people out of the equation.
And if we do need people in smaller scale agriculture, I think of the intelligence of those Chinese farmers to be able to support, 20 people on an eighth of an acre of land, as F.H. King found them doing. One little chunk of land, eighth of an acre, is, sustaining 20 people. That is a tremendous amount of intellectual firepower at work there. Where would we find that know-how these days, John?
That is an intriguing question. In the work that we have done and the research that we have done working with farmers and with academia, we have found a fascinating paradox in that there is a great deal of incredible knowledge about how to grow healthy crops and how to develop regenerative agricultural systems, but the knowledge and the information is compartmentalized. Farming is really the profession of a generalist. Farmers need to know a great deal about many different things. They need to understand botany and entomology and plant physiology.
You sound like Thomas Jefferson.
Well, so what, unfortunately today in our agricultural research and also in our agricultural education, we have compartmentalized all these various pieces, and information is not being cross-pollinated across the various barriers. Today we have, in research, we have plant physiologists and botanists and agronomists and plant biochemists and the geneticists. The list goes on and on. And all of these various professions believe that the answer to agricultural challenges lies within their own domain of research. So there is not effective cross-pollination of ideas. So what we found quite intriguing was that there is, in fact, a great deal of research to support the concepts of a regenerative agricultural system. We have the knowledge and we have the information today within our university research system and within older farmers to know how to develop truly regenerative models of agriculture, models in which soil health is constantly improving. We're regenerating ecology, improving water quality and water supplies and water use efficiency. We have that knowledge. We have the information. We're simply doing a pathetic job of implementing what we already know.
Huh. Misha, what do you think? Do you think that there is that kind of intellectual firepower in the industrial model? It seems like those people who grow on a very large scale are very, very smart, but their information and knowledge base is very, very refined into tiny little spectrums of places, right?
Yeah, oh yeah, they're hyper-specialized. I mean, once a soy farmer, always a soy farmer, that guy's not going to try to branch out and, you know, maybe grow a cover crop or introduce something into his rotation. No, 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 those guys are like, they're addicted to the chemicals and they're addicted to the money. And John's quite right. It's partly due to the hyper-specialization in our world of academia. But let's not forget the regulatory roadblock here.
And well, that's what we're going to pick up when we get back from this break. Folks, when we get back, we're going to talk about what kind of agriculture we, through our government, should support. Should we support one kind of agriculture at the expense of the other? And should we regulate one at the expense of the other? What do you think? This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with John Kemp, Misha Popoff, and you, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right. Well, folks, it's an absolute imperative. Agriculture must become more productive to feed our future's billions. 9.1 billion by 2050. How will agriculture produce 70% more food? Seems like it must become very, very smart to do that. And so that brings us to a very interesting question. Should we, as a people, through our governments, support the development of one kind of agriculture over the other? It seems like kind of that's what we've been doing over the years. Those who have lots of money go to government and purchase influence, and they earn by themselves a seat at the center of power, and through that influence they give direction to the government's support of one form of agriculture over another. And if you look at who's sitting in the catbird seat in Washington, D.C. these days, and pretty much every day, you'll see that it is those who have lots of money and have consolidated lots of power. And so we're wondering, is it possible, you know, for us as a people through our governments to support both of them, or should we just allow those with money to have their way with our governments? John Kemp, what do you think?
Well, ultimately, you achieve what you incentivize.
Oh.
So my thoughts go back to the conversation, the discussion that we were having a few minutes ago. What we have incentivized is the current model of agriculture, and if we want to go in a different direction, then I believe that there are a number of native inherent economic advantages to ecological agriculture. As soon, for example, and there are many potential possible examples, but I'll use one example. If you produce foods that have higher quality, whether it could be corn that has a higher protein content, it could be tomatoes or blueberries that have a higher anthocyanin content, or tomatoes that have a higher lycopene content, as you produce greater quality, that food has more inherent value. It really now has the potential to become food as medicine, much more so than a lot of the food that is being produced by the industrial model. But specific economic advantages occur when this healthier, higher quality food has a much stronger shelf life, a much longer shelf life. According to the Food and Agriculture Organization, today we don't just have a production problem. We actually grow enough food today to feed the world's population in 2050. However, we waste 50% of it. We don't really have a food production problem as much as we have a political and a distribution problem. So with that being said, there are economic incentives to producing healthier, higher quality food, even with the current system, even with our current markets as they are. The one piece that is missing, this goes back to the research piece, is, as Misha commented, our agriculture research and our education has become very specialized. And this is very challenging for students who wish to become farmers, because unfortunately they're being taught a specific subjects more and more about less and less, until they really finally know everything about nothing. And they don't have the broad general base. That same holds true in research, where our research in agriculture and our use of the scientific method has been to emphasize single factor analysis, let's narrow everything down to a single factor and research that single factor. Agriculture research really needs to be focused on systems research. What are the various systems that we need? So we're not today, we're not doing research on the systems that the Chinese were using back in the early 1900s, for example. And I believe there's a great deal that we could learn from looking at more integrated systems.
Misha, it seems like an impossibility, though, to research the general things like that when the money is really tightly focused on industrial processes that can be patented and controlled.
Yeah, well, I think each farm is a laboratory. But right now, if, say, a conventional farmer, an industrial-scale farmer, wants to try some organic practices, he's sort of sticking his neck out. No one's really going to back him. Vice versa, if an organic farmer wants to try something from the industrial side, he risks being decertified and being put out of business. Now, in 1998, Bill Clinton and the Secretary of Agriculture reached back to FHK, and they wanted to include sewage in organic standards. Now, it would have to be properly handled, of course. Mm-hmm. And that's what really what drove this high level of efficiency you were talking about in China.
Where absolutely.
So many people off of.
Yeah. Nothing was wasted, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're flushing that stuff out into the sea. It's wasted, and that's how you get the hypoxic zones in the Gulf of Mexico.
Of course, they didn't have the. And you know, China's really a great expression of what we're talking about here, because when Chairman Mao instituted his Great Leap Forward and began industrializing Chinese agriculture and changing the way those farmers of 40 centuries produce food from that ecological model of small space-intensive agriculture to industrial models of big tractors and lots of chemicals. Today, 90% of China's surface water and 20% of its arable farmland are irretrievably contaminated with toxic heavy metals. Now, to feed itself, China is buying up Africa to employ those industrial models. So it's kind of like a real head scratcher there. But gee whiz, when we get back from this last break, I have a few minutes left, and I really want to ask John Kemp, Misha Popoff, what they see happening in the year 2050. What kind of agriculture really is it going to take to feed 9.1 billion of us? Will it be the agriculture that amplifies natural processes, uses the processes of nature to amplify production, or will it be the processes of industry that redirect those natural processes with chemicals and whatnot? This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson, Misha Popoff, and John Kemp, and you. Thank you all. We will be right back. Don't go away.
Frank Muller has been farming in Woodland with his brothers Louie and Tom for as long as they can remember.
We've been farming since we were kids, but the college years at UC Davis were the big years, because what we learned there, we brought home. Today, we're still working to make farming more productive and friendlier for the environment. Yeah, the future of agriculture looks good.
Find out how UC Davis partners with growers like the Mullers at onecalifornia.ucdavis.edu.
Well, there's two kinds of approaches to this business of feeding ourselves in the future. One is kind of ecological, the other is industrial. John Kemp was talking about how the ecological model produces plants that are full of smarts and intelligence and healthy because they've had all of the nutrition that they've needed while growing up. And thus, people who eat those kinds of foods will also be smart and intelligent and healthy and strong and vibrant. But John, I have to ask you, do you think really that those who pull the strings of power and control in the world want a population of smart people running around?
What kind of a question is that?
Well, I don't know. I sometimes think that they don't want a population of smart, healthy people. I sometimes think that they want a population of dull, dumb people.
Well, based on the policies that we have been implementing and the practices that we've been implementing, I would tend to say that if we look at the practice rather than the words, it would tend to bear you out.
That's what I'm afraid of. Looking down the line, do you think ecological agriculture can hold us up in 2050?
Not only do I believe that it can hold us up, I believe that it is our only viable option. The industrial agricultural model that we have adopted over the last seven decades is resulting in a rapid degradation of our topsoil and of our soil fertility and of our soil nutritional integrity. So from my perspective, today there's a lot of discussion about sustainability in agriculture. Sustainability is not enough. We can no longer be sustainable. We first need to have a discussion about a regenerative agriculture, models in which soil and plant health are constantly improving and getting better and better. And only when we achieve a higher plateau of performance can we have a discussion about sustainability. We're not even there today.
We have nothing to sustain yet.
Right.
Misha, what do you think?
I got cut off before, but it was Bill Clinton who tried to reach back to F.H. King and incorporate switch. He also wanted the organic industry to admit genetic engineering on a case-by-case basis. So the vision in the 1990s was to stretch both ways, backwards in time to the ecological model, also forward in time to technology, because who would deny that technology isn't useful in agriculture? Both of those ideas were rejected by the leaders of the organic industry, not by John, but by the actual leadership, the people who run Whole Foods and who run...
Why is it that we have this conflict between these two agricultures? Do you think, like Rodney King says, that we can't we just get along?
That's when the conflict began, and to his credit, Bill Clinton saw that this could be the future. Instead, when the leaders of the organic industry rejected the use of sewage and rejected the new science of genetic engineering, they basically guaranteed the organic industry would always just be this niche cottage industry, which, you know, it's lucky if it hits 2 or 3% of food production in certain sectors.
Well, okay, Misha, I want to thank you for those comments and those thoughts, and thank you, John Kemp, from Advancing Ecological Agriculture, Misha Popoff for Is It Organic, and thank you all out there for tuning in. This has been The Food Chain. We're looking down the road, way down the road, to 2050, and we're scratching our head and wondering what kind of agriculture can sustain us then. And maybe it will be a combination of the ecological and the industrial. Let's hope we can all find a way of finding the way. This has been The Food Chain. Michael Olson, thank you all for tuning in. Remember, agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.
You're listening to KSCO AM 1080 Santa Cruz, KOMY AM 1340 La Selva Beach, Watsonville. It is 10 a.m. Here is CBS News.
CBS News, I'm Pam Coulter. Health officials say the number of Ebola cases in Africa is now over 10,000.